Goodman, thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe.
La ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Et perdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là. Quand soudain je me retourne, il se recule et la foule vient me jeter entre ses bras. Emportés par la foule qui nous entraîne, écrasés l'un contre l'autre, nous ne formons qu'un seul corps.
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hi, I'm Rick Mitchell, and I would like to invite you to check out my program, Jazz in the New Millennium, at kboo.fm. Each one-hour program focuses on a living jazz artist, putting their work in historical perspective from their earliest recordings to their most recent. The current season features such primetime players as Jason Moran, Diane Reeves, Christian McBride, Terrence Blanchard, and John Scofield. The weekly program is syndicated nationally by the African American Public Radio Consortium. It can be heard anytime on KBOO's website by going to the drop-down menu at kboo.fm, clicking on audio, then podcasts, and scrolling down to the Jazz in the New Millennium page. New shows are posted weekly. That's Jazz in the New Millennium with Rick Mitchell at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Delta variant makes up over 80% of Oregon COVID cases. A new heat wave blankets the region until late Saturday, and utility companies block the transition to clean energy. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 30th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The Delta variant of the coronavirus now accounts for 88% of cases in Oregon, experts say. Vaccinated people are protected against severe cases of the Delta variant, but unvaccinated people aren't so lucky. Viruses evolve and change over time as they are spread from person to person. The Delta variant is more contagious. It spreads twice as fast as the original. Research has shown that it also loads up infected people with more of the virus, increasing their viral load, which makes them sicker. 92% of people who tested positive for COVID-19 in June weren't vaccinated, according to the Oregon Health Authority. Oregon case numbers are surging, but state officials haven't yet intervened. 285 hospital beds are occupied by COVID patients, pretty close to the 300 mark, which used to trigger greater COVID-19 restrictions. Yesterday, 999 Oregonians tested positive for coronavirus, and 6 died of the disease. That brings the state death toll from the pandemic to 2,884. Case rates in the state have increased 167% in 2 weeks. That's the highest level since mid-May. On Thursday, Governor Kate Brown announced she would require masks in K-12 schools following guidance issued by the CDC. The federal government has also recommended that people wear masks in public indoor settings in counties that have high COVID rates. But these and the measures from the governor are so far only recommendations, not requirements. New CDC guidelines recommend that even vaccinated people wear masks in areas with high coronavirus case numbers. That includes teachers, students, and school staff who will be required to mask up while in school this fall. Educators are welcoming this guidance. Lily Bolke has more on the story from Massachusetts.
Educators unions are calling on the state to support their efforts to ensure in-person learning in the fall keeps students, teachers, families, and staff safe. With the Delta variant making its way through the nation, the CDC issued guidance this week recommending that all teachers, students, and staff in K-12 schools wear masks, even if they've received a COVID vaccine. Mary Najimy, president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, says this guidance is welcome, with kids under 12 still not approved to receive the vaccine and the vaccination rate among 12 to 15-year-olds still low. Najimy thinks other strategies are needed.
We can have full in-person learning as safely as possible this fall. Masking was one of three or four critical mitigation strategies that really helped control transmission in the school buildings.
She adds another critical piece is school buildings, ventilation systems. She says many districts have schools that need upgrades. The union is also urging the Commonwealth to provide continued free and accessible COVID testing. Najimy notes while being vaccinated is enough to protect most people, COVID still poses a risk to children under 12 or people whose immune systems don't respond to the vaccine. She adds communities of color have been hit the hardest by the pandemic and feels there is a collective responsibility to ensure that everybody is safe.
We have the right formula to do that in schools. It's ventilation, masking, distancing, hand washing, and testing. So there's no reason why the state can't step up and provide the leadership that we need at this moment.
The Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education had been planning to lift all COVID restrictions in schools this fall, and Governor Charlie Baker said prior to the updated recommendations that he wasn't considering a mask mandate. This week, his office said it will review the updated CDC guidance. This is Lily Bolke with Commonwealth News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators for transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Heat is back in Oregon with advisories out until 11 p.m. this evening for Northwest Oregon and Southwest Washington, as well as Southwest Oregon. Temperatures could hit 104 degrees in the southwest part of the state, and as a result, the governor has declared a state of emergency related to heat waves in 23 counties. The last heat wave resulted in 116 deaths in Oregon, most of them elderly folks with no air conditioning. The temperatures aren't expected to be quite as high, but the risks are still severe. Multnomah County will be opening 5 cooling centers and extending the operating hours of 15 libraries to help residents get relief from the heat. A fire weather watch has also been issued since there's abundant dry fuel that could become fire starts with lightning from thunderstorms. A National Weather Service meteorologist told the Statesman Journal that the lightning may strike along the Cascade Crest from Detroit to Santiam Pass into central Oregon. Emergency managers say they are better prepared for this heat wave than the last one. Over 800 people across the state suffered from heat-related illnesses last month. In Multnomah County, one flaw in the official response plan was that the 211 help phone line was not staffed on weekends. That meant that people were unable to get assistance, like a ride to a cooling shelter when they really needed it. Officials say they were unaware that 211 was not staffed during the weekends and at the height of the crisis, and they say that this time around the phone line will be staffed around the clock. Heat advisories in some parts of the state last until 11 p.m. on Saturday, and residents are advised to prepare for temperatures at or approaching 100 degrees. Folks are recommended to stay hydrated and inside when possible and to check on their neighbors. Houseless campers next to Laurelhurst Park were swept from their encampment Thursday morning. The sweep notice was first posted on Monday. Campers have been set up on the sidewalk on and off for some time. The most recent sweep was prompted by a report from a city contractor who reportedly saw weapons shown by campers in the area. Laurelhurst Park is in an upscale neighborhood, and until yesterday, it hosted the largest houseless encampment in Portland. Neighbors and campers had repeatedly clashed over the past months. City officials, advocates, service outreach workers, cops, and cleanup crews were on the scene Thursday. 70 campers were displaced with no clear place to go after their eviction. Some were only allowed an hour to move their belongings before they were bagged or trashed by rapid response workers. Trespassing after the police moved that cleanup line would mean risking arrest or detention. On at least two prior occasions, activists successfully deterred sweeps of the camps, but this time the Portland City Council unanimously declared that the camp would be removed. Sue Palin of the advocacy group Defense Fund PDX said this to the Oregonian, quote, "Residents and volunteers and anyone who wasn't police or rapid response were told they had to leave. That meant that even though rapid response was bagging and labeling things to save, nothing was being tagged properly since residents weren't there to say which things belonged to who. That makes it impossible for them to be able to reclaim their items after the fact," end quote. Houseless individuals filed a class action lawsuit in May against the city of Portland for losing their possessions during another camp sweep. Congress passes Capitol security funding. Meanwhile, the House Freedom Caucus wants Representatives Cheney and Kinzinger out of the Republican conference. With those stories and more, it's Tramell Gomes with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is not Pelosi's house, this is the people's house.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy criticized Speaker Nancy Pelosi from the steps of the Capitol. He blamed Pelosi and the Democrats for the violent January attack there by a pro-Trump mob. McCarthy's moves follow the testimony of four Capitol police officers who pointed to former President Trump's calls for insurrection. Republican Congressman and Freedom Caucus member Andy Biggs is calling for the removal of Representatives Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois from the House GOP for joining the committee investigating the violence.
To have sitting in your conference individuals who have professed that they want to take out the minority leader and that they want to go on join the Democrats on a witch hunt.
Congress passed a $2.1 billion Capitol security funding bill Thursday, money for the Capitol Police, the National Guard, and other agencies to cover costs related to the January 6th riot. It's headed to President Biden's desk for a likely signature. Also Thursday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said all 50 Democrats will vote to move forward on the party's $3.5 trillion infrastructure and social spending proposal.
The agreement will ultimately dedicate over $1 trillion to strengthening virtually every major category of our country's physical infrastructure.
It would include a major expansion of high-speed internet, spending for roads, bridges, public transit, climate change initiatives, and clean drinking water. The bill provoked a torrent of criticism by former President Donald Trump. In an effort to push more Americans to get vaccinated, President Biden bluntly said if you are unvaccinated, you present a problem to yourself, your family, and to those with whom you work. Biden said every federal government employee and on-site contractor will have to show their vaccination status. To help encourage people to follow through, the administration announced paid leave for employees who take time off to get the shot for themselves or their family members. And Biden called on states to offer $100 vaccination incentives. I'm Tramell Gomes for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30 for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Tonight's weather will be balmy, with evening temperatures only dipping down to 73 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 91. There's a heat advisory in effect for many parts of Oregon through Saturday night. Today in history, in 1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson signs the Social Security Act of 1965 into law, creating Medicare and Medicaid. The quote of the day is from author Emily Bronte, who was born this day in 1818. She said, quote, "I am now quite cured of seeking pleasure in society, be it in country or town. A sensible man ought to find sufficient company in himself." tribal lawsuit filed recently claims that Montana schools aren't meeting Native history requirements. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana's American Civil Liberties Union and the Native American Rights Fund filed a lawsuit against the state of Montana on behalf of Montana tribes in late July. The lawsuit alleges requirements to teach Native American history in public schools are not being met. Yellowstone Public Radio's Taylor Stagner has more.
Montana is the only state that is constitutionally mandated to provide indigenous education in K through 12 public schools. Since 2007, the state has provided $3.5 million per year to support the Indian Education for All Act. This suit says there's not enough oversight on curriculum outcomes or how districts are managing funds. Melody McCoy is a Native American Rights Fund attorney on this case. She says public schools are supposed to use the money to integrate indigenous education into the whole curriculum.
It might well be that some of this is happening. What we're not seeing is that it's being reported, and we're not seeing that the state is requiring it to be reported.
McCoy says that funds might be being spent on inappropriate material, but without proper documentation, it's hard to know.
We did find that one school district had purchased a book about Squanto and the miracle of Thanksgiving and reported that as an Indian Education for All expenditure.
The lawsuit is seeking that state officials and agencies meet reporting and compliance standards in consultation with the tribes. For National Native News, I'm Taylor Stagner.
A magnitude 8.2 earthquake hit offshore of the Alaska Peninsula this week. The National Tsunami Center issued warnings for much of the Gulf of Alaska coastline. Gene Carlson is a commercial fisherman in Chignik Bay. He says the earthquake was particularly violent.
Things were falling out of the cabinets and drawers were flopping open. Looked up, my car was jumping around on the road. There was a lot of landslides here, too. You could see just clouds of... It was just dust everywhere. So, yeah, then we tried to gather ourselves together because with one like that, you never know if you're going to get a tidal wave. So people were running all over trying to get in the cars and get up on the hill.
There were no immediate reports of major damage or injuries. It was the state's largest earthquake since 1965. Officials say any waves were likely to be smaller than a foot. Carlson says he had not heard of any damage, though he was checking again.
We did watch the tide. I think, we had a little semi-tidal wave here because the tide went out and then it came back in pretty good. Because we were watching it from a hill.
The National Tsunami Warning Center recommends that anyone with damage to report should contact their local emergency manager or their local National Weather Service office. Lummi Carvers, tribal leaders, and members of grassroots groups delivered a totem pole Thursday to the Biden administration in Washington, D.C. It was their final stop after a cross-country journey highlighting indigenous issues and sacred site protection. Carver Doug James says the totem is a gift for the people, animals, and the earth.
For those that don't have voices, that's who we're reaching out to. And we're just asking each and every one of you to come together with one heart and one mind. Aitchwalun means to be of one heart and one mind. So with that, I just want to say Haishka Nestella Chasi to all my relations. Oseum.
The totem pole event on the National Mall was live streamed, featuring speakers from the Biden administration and tribal leaders from across the country. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
An 8.2 magnitude earthquake struck off the coast of Alaska Wednesday night, sparking tsunami fears. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
A magnitude 8.2 earthquake struck off the southern coast of Alaska Wednesday night. This was the largest U.S. earthquake in 50 years. The earthquake occurred about 60 miles away from Perryville, which is a village on the Alaska Peninsula. The quake was strongly felt throughout the region. After the earthquake, residents of Kodiak Island, the largest island in Alaska, anxiously awaited the possibility of a tsunami. A formal tsunami warning was issued shortly after the earthquake occurred, and evacuations occurred throughout multiple coastal towns and cities. A tsunami was generated, but was quickly deemed to not be a threat. 1 hour and 45 minutes after the initial warning occurred, it was downgraded to an advisory, and later was completely canceled. A tsunami watch was also issued for Hawaii and was also canceled. Alaska is the most seismically active state in the U.S., and it is the site of the second largest earthquake ever recorded. The Alaska Peninsula itself records thousands of quakes each year. This time, there were at least two aftershocks of magnitude 6.2 and 5.6. There were no reports of injuries or major damage. The 1964 Good Friday earthquake, magnitude 9.2, caused massive destruction and loss of life across South Central Alaska. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
The growth of clean energy is being stymied by power companies, according to a new report in Florida. Rooftop solar power is a promising way of generating clean power, but utilities in Florida and elsewhere have been using their influence to block broader use. Tramell Gomes has the story.
A new report shows an effort by investor-owned utilities in the Sunshine State to block the growth of rooftop solar. The Environment Florida Research and Policy Center report follows a money trail claiming utilities have spent millions to undercut the advances in solar power in Florida and six other states, and at the federal level. Ryan Lynn with the center says the company's main targets have been to restrict or eliminate net metering programs. Net metering allows private solar users to get credit for energy they add to the grid. Lynn says utility companies also add new fixed charges to solar power systems.
We've also found financial records showing that this money goes forth putting together front groups to put out reports claiming that pro-solar policies hurt customers or that some policy that is helpful to the growth of solar should be changed for some reason.
Other groups like the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy say it takes a strong show of support to fight the influence of investor-owned utilities. That was the case a year ago when Florida's Public Service Commission decided not to change the state's net metering rule for at least 2 years. It was hailed as a victory by environmental groups. And while it may seem like the power companies have now embraced the expansion of solar by building or investing in solar farms, Lynn says her group's research indicates the motive is almost always financial, not environmental.
If you are producing your own solar via panels on your house and getting paid for that through net metering policies, or if you're buying into a power purchase agreement through a third-party utility, that interrupts their bottom line. So it's not that they're completely anti-solar, but they're against solar that they don't control.
The Solar Energy Industries Association ranks Florida fourth in the nation for solar power potential. But Lynn says the state is hardly meeting that potential. Solar accounts for less than 4% of the total electricity generated in the state. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
Households waste more than 500 million metric tons of food each year. That's more than is wasted in restaurants and grocery stores combined. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. From farms and factories to restaurants and homes, about a third of all the food produced in the world goes to waste. And it's not just a waste of money and resources. It's also a major contributor to global warming. When food rots in a landfill, it produces methane, a potent greenhouse gas. And when food gets thrown out, more food needs to be grown, processed, packaged, transported, and sold. All of those activities create carbon pollution that warms the climate.
If food waste was a country, it would be the third biggest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions on the planet behind the US and China.
Richard Swanell is with RAP, a UK-based NGO that focuses on waste reduction. His group co-authored a recent report with the UN Environment Program. It found that individual households produce more than 500 million metric tons of food waste a year. That's more than the amount of food that's wasted at restaurants and grocery stores combined. So he says food waste is a problem across the supply chain, but everyone can help by addressing it at home.
Buy what you need and eat what you buy. And if we do those two things, that will dramatically reduce food waste.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Marijuana legalization may soon reach Ohio. Supporters say that legalization will be a boon to the economy, as it has been in many other states, but they face pushback on concerns about health and safety. Mary Sherman has more.
Ohio legalized medical marijuana in 2016, and some lawmakers are pushing to legalize it for recreational use as well. House Bill 201 would also allow for the expungement of some convictions and for marijuana to be grown at home. While the bill is unlikely to pass, co-sponsor State Rep. Cedric Denson of Cincinnati is hoping it will promote awareness about the benefits of legalization, including economic growth.
Progressive states are seeing the benefits of and actually opening up a whole new industry for business opportunities, and it's working. And the sky has not fallen and things are not falling apart in those states.
Drug prevention groups want to keep marijuana illegal, focusing on its negative aspects, from increases in crashes to accidental ingestion by children. Fran Gerbig is executive director of the Prevention Action Alliance.
It's not that we are condemning the substance per se, it's just that there's not been enough research. And we don't know the true impact of cannabis on the health and wellness of an individual.
Ohio voters failed to pass a 2015 ballot initiative that would have legalized recreational marijuana use. 64% of voters opposed it and 36% approved. Cleveland cannabis lawyer Tom Heron believes recreational marijuana will be legalized in Ohio within this decade, either through state or federal action. If the latter happens first, Heron says Ohio could face a number of regulatory problems.
That means it's no longer illegal to possess it. It's no longer illegal to traffic in it, to sell it, distribute it. So you would still have within the medical program a very highly regulated system, but then you would have a separate, unregulated, and legal market.
Douglas Berman heads the Drug Enforcement and Policy Center at The Ohio State University. He thinks legalized marijuana would lead to a series of changes in law enforcement regulation.
We still have some of those laws in place, but I think we'd see a radical reduction in how they get enforced because not everyone would be subject to arrest. Only those that are breaking the regulations would be.
He adds possession and trafficking arrests plummeted in nearly every state that fully legalized marijuana. This story was produced with original reporting from Troy Pearson at Kent State University. Support for this reporting was provided by Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gunn Foundation. I'm Mary Sherman, reporting for Ohio News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support accuracy and transparency online at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 30th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Tramel Gomes, Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bulkey, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
This is Ramona Africa, and you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your dial. KBOO is the exact example of the community taking charge of itself. On the move.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you've almost certainly seen the documentary photographs. They're emblematic. African Americans trying to walk to school or sit at a drugstore soda fountain while white people yell and spit and scream at them. Should no one see those pictures or learn those stories? Because some of them have skin the same color as those doing the spitting and the screaming? The most recent attack on anti-racist education is labeled as protective, as avoiding division, and as a specific assessment of critical race theory. To the extent that corporate media have bought into that labeling, they've misinformed the public, not just about critical race theory, but about a campaign whose own architects say is about disinforming, confusing, and inflaming people into resisting any actual effort to understand or respond to persistent racial inequity. Luke Charles Harris is co-founder and deputy director of the African American Policy Forum. He joins us today to talk about what's at issue. Also on the show, Democracy and Technology and digital rights groups around the world signed on to a letter in support of encryption, the ability of journalists, human rights defenders, and everyone else to have private